I think it is one thing to see God's action in scripture, in the burning bush. It is another to perceive God's effectiveness underlying everyday events, which involve suffering and even destruction. This poem is kind of asking if we can see the paradox of the cross in our everyday lived experience. If we can see, even in dark and destructive things, that there could be those two simultaneous and competing realities of loss and gain. And I think if we can perceive that in our daily lives, it makes a powerful case to choose to live out of the fire life.
I'm talking today with Laura Rees Hogan, whose book, I Live No Longer I, Paul's Spirituality of Suffering, Transformation, and Joy, won 4 First Place Catholic Press Association Book Awards. Laura is also the award-winning poet of the volume Litany of Flights, the holder of advanced degrees in theology and law, and is a Third Order Carmelite. We discuss the relationship between theology and poetry and the transformative spirituality that sits at the heart of the Christian vision. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Laura Rees Hogan, it is a real delight to talk with you today. Thank you for coming on here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, I asked my guests how faith figures into their life and work. And in your case, I'm especially intrigued by the conjunction of different facets of your life. So you're a theologian. You hold a Master of Arts in Theology. You earned a law degree from UCLA, my alma mater for my PhD. And you're also an award-winning poet and a mother of multiple children. So my question is, does your faith play any role in how these things link together?
Yes, I'd say that my faith plays a governing role in how all those aspects come together in my life. I'm a Catholic, and within that tradition, I'm a Third Order Carmelite, which means that I'm a lay member of the Carmelite order. So the way I live out my spirituality and my life is kind of informed by that charism, that particular blend of contemplation and action that we see in the Carmelite tradition. So faith in combination, probably with my intellectual curiosity, has played a big role in my life as a mother and in the pursuits over my lifetime of law, theology, and poetry. And in particular, I think my spirituality threads pretty clearly throughout my theology and my poetry.
Yeah, certainly. What I've read, that's certainly the case. In fact, you know, we're going to talk today about that connection between your work as a theologian and a poet. And this may be a kind of a chicken and egg question, okay? But did one of those vocations come first to you?
That's such a good question, actually, Matt. Because on the one hand, I've written poetry since I was a child. But on the other, I only seriously reapproached poetry while in the thick of writing theology, actually. About halfway through writing I Live No Longer I, kind of in an effort to find new ways to open the theological concepts to the readers, perhaps through personal stories, I started writing poems as a way of journaling. When I'd written those poems, I was able to return to I Live No Longer I and finish the work. But the poems I had written actually ended up being published as my poetry chapbook, O Garden Dweller. Both the theology and the poetry books were actually published in the same year. And I really view them as twins, two sides of the same coin, two languages, if you will, two very different expression of the same truths that I was kind of thinking about at the time. So I'd say that the theology and the poetry are intertwined in that way for me, chicken and egg, and that they inform and grow one another.
Okay, can I just say that's amazing to me that these poems that I've read in the volume Litany of Flights were beginning as journal entries, because Laura, if I created poems and journal entries, they would be sheer doggerel. I find it amazing that you did that so well.
Thank you, Matt.
Now, I'd seen your book, I Live No Longer I, reviewed someplace. I think it was the journal Spiritus, and I thought it looked compelling, so I bought it and I read it, and I was grateful that I did, because I took a lot from that book. But the idea to invite you as a podcast guest was born when I came across your poetry. right? And I saw that it was published in a later issue of Spiritus, and I thought, wait, this writer, this theologian, is also a poet? So I bought that collection of poems, A Litany of Flights, and loved it and thought, okay, I want to talk with Laura about these two books. So here's a question I have for you. I can see how one would produce a volume of poems, right? You have a poetic vision. Poems come together through a combination of inspiration and craft. You find a publisher, etc. But how did you find the courage to publish a book of theology on Paul, right? Because biblical scholarship on Paul is so abundant, as you well know, and it's been abundant for centuries and centuries. What convinced you that you had something substantive to say, as you clearly did?
For me, it was such an organic process of questioning. I went to the seminary with questions about the human condition, and I dug into my theological studies for answers to that, and then ultimately being very surprised to discover new things in Paul that spoke deeply to me, revealed new ways of looking at my own relationship with God. It helped me radically, and I really wanted to share that gift with others, and that was the impetus for writing the book.
Okay. What was the impetus then to go into the seminary to get an advanced degree in theology? What was that impetus for you?
Again, it was, you know, I think those big questions about human suffering, and at the time I already had become a third order Carmelite. So those questions were very folded together with that spirituality. And I have intellectual curiosity. I kind of always had. So I really was drawn to theology, to the seminary. Yeah.
Okay. I've actually talked to a lot of other theologians who have talked about people both in theology and in religious studies, which is kind of the more secular branch of the study of religion, who talk about the thing that drove them into it was like the fascination with these huge questions, right?
Yes.
That really can't be answered only through history or cultural context, but they're asking kind of larger things still. Mm-hmm. So what you say there resonates with what I've heard from others who've gone into that area. Donald Sr. Wrote the foreword to your book, I Live No Longer I, and he wrote something that I thought was interesting. Here's what he says, I'm quoting him. He says that most of the prevailing scholarship on Paul is focused on understanding what Paul meant in his writings and how his original audiences might have understood them. The focus of this work, by contrast, this work meaning your book, is on what Paul's theology means now. While drawing on much of this accumulated Pauline scholarship, Laura's interest is in the meaning of Paul's theology for contemporary Christian spirituality and life. Okay, so these big questions then that you had worked itself into this book. If your interest is in contemporary spirituality and life, why did you decide to address that by way of Paul, right? Why not a book on contemporary Christian spirituality and life taken from, say, the Gospel of John, or the writings of Teresa of Avila from the mystical tradition, or somewhere else?
I think sometimes we forget, and it's easy to forget, that Paul, the great apostle, was also a human being. He encountered Jesus, yes, he was a mystic, yes, but he also suffered, and really terribly. He was whipped, stoned, beaten, imprisoned in a first century prison so bad that prisoners were completely expected to die. And internally also, he was full of concerns and worry for his churches. So how did he keep going? What kept his eyes on the prize despite all the struggle? How in the world was he flooded with joy? Because he clearly was. So in answer to this really good question, Matt, of why address Christian spirituality today by way of Paul, for me, it's because his struggle is precisely our struggle as Christians, like in an everyday way. And I found profound depth in his letters, speaking straight into my everyday life. I found patterns and insights in his thought that gave me a way forward in my own life.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. I'm almost blown away when I come to the chapter in Acts. I forget which chapter it is where Paul describes being stoned, and then the next day he's back out there again. You know, it's like, okay, this is somebody of unusual enduring capacity. All right. So the subtitle of the book, again, the book titled I Live No Longer I, is taken from a verse in Galatians. The subtitle, though, Paul's Spirituality of Suffering, Transformation, and Joy. Would you say that that relationship between spirituality, suffering, and joy kind of captures the spirit or aim of your book's argument?
Yes, I would say that the relationship between suffering, transformation, and joy does capture the spirit of the book's argument in a lot of different ways. Transformation or shift in mind and heart being really critically important because I think, in my opinion, so much of what Paul was trying to share with his young communities was about perception and discernment. He wanted them to see everything through the lens of the cross of Christ because he himself had discovered that was the key to understanding his identity as a follower of Jesus. And we see that kind of repeatedly in his letters. And the big key in Paul is paradox. The key is that there are two simultaneous and competing realities. One, an earthly reality, which might involve weakness, loss, defeat, and suffering. But equally, there is a heavenly reality of power, gain, victory, and joy. So Paul wanted his communities to be able to perceive that other reality kind of hidden, if you will, under the earthly appearances that we all encounter every single day and choose to live out of that other reality, the heavenly reality.
Okay, let me ask you about that. That dual reality, is it's, I think, such a central part of Christian experience, certainly Christian belief, right? That we dwell here mm-hmm. in one state of being. We don't believe that, that all of life, all of the duration across eternity need have, you know, kind of these mortal problems attached to it. Do you find that you yourself have this kind of bifocal vision as a common part of your Christian experience, or do you find that you have to really struggle and work to remind yourself of the kind of heavenly joy you say that Paul is living out in some capacity, even through his earthly struggle?
I think that at first, when we're trying to approach this kind of spirituality, it's more of an intellectual approach. But as you progress in the spiritual life, they become positions you fall back on in a more unconscious way. For me, that joy really comes, and I know that this may come over a period of building a relationship with God, certainly, but falling back into that core relationship with God is to me such a source of joy that I can access, you know, even if I'm not having a great or at a great place in my life. The idea of God ultimately just always being in relationship with us and finding joy in that is so powerful. Also, the idea that I was kind of just expressing that we find in Paul of God ultimately being effective to accomplish his divine purpose, whatever the circumstances in our life, that we can kind of count on that. And that's a joyful thing. So yes, it can be really difficult to, you know, encounter difficult things in our life, but that's, as Christians, that's really our source of joy.
I think that's really great, Laura. I really appreciate that. You know, I'm talking with another guest on the podcast, and this is a conversation I have with a lot of people these days, is that I'm in a stage of my life now when I've never quite felt so beset with heavy care, but also at the same time never quite so blessed. And the blessing takes the form not of material circumstance, but really more of a sense of peace in God's presence and peace in God's providence. And those really can be simultaneous realities. You know, that's certainly my experience. What you say really resonates with me.
I just think it's amazing that paradox is a very real thing, that you can kind of hold both of those realities at the same time, the earthly cares, which are very real and can be very heavy, and at the same time you can really hold this, this heavenly reality, this true and real experience of connection with God.
Yeah, that's
Yes.
great. Now you make a really important distinction in your book between joy on the one hand and happiness on the other. Can you elaborate on that difference for our listeners?
Well, I think we can experience happiness in our lives, when good things happen, when we enjoy the ones we love and what we do here. But the concept of joy in Paul, kind of like I just mentioned, is so directly tied, just like it is in the Hebrew scriptures, which of course inform Paul, directly tied to joy in God, joy in relationship with God. So joy arises from something far beyond our earthly experiences, beyond even the bounds of life and death. No matter what's going on, we can access that joy, take joy in God, our relationship with God. And again, that idea that God's always going to prevail, he's always going to be accomplished, effective to accomplish his good purpose in and through our lives, no matter what the circumstances.
Yeah, you know, I kind of, over the years, have kind of come to my own way of thinking about the difference between those two things. And tell me if this sort of sounds right to you or if you modify what I'm saying. I think about the difference between, well, happiness is kind of a feeling. I'm happy that it was a good day, or I'm happy that, the Dodgers won the World Series a couple of years ago or whatever. I'm happy. But joy is not a feeling, it's more a state of being. And therefore, joy can accompany, kind of a range of emotion. That there could be sadness, but still an underwriting joy. There can be happiness and an underwriting joy. There can be tragedy, but still underwriting joy. Whereas happiness kind of is an emotion that kind of flits, and it's more ephemeral. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that absolutely sounds right. And I think happiness is more directly tied to whatever we're currently experiencing, in our lives. But joy is something that just goes so deep and so beyond that. And I look at Paul, being imprisoned and suffering, but able to experience this very transcendent joy. I think of Bonhoeffer, who was facing his own death, and he's writing this letter of joy. It's definitely something not tied to, a life, an immediate life circumstances, connecting with something beyond that.
Yeah,
So I
great.
think you're right on that.
Yeah, okay. And one of the things that I really took from your book that I thought was really profound was this connection you draw between three Greek words, the words kenosis, enosis, and theosis. Can you explain to our listeners what these words mean and how they figure in your book?
Sure. So a really key element in the spirituality of Paul is understanding kind of three moments or ways in which we experience relationship with God. And the Christ hymn in Philippians, which is Philippians 2, 6 through 11, gives us kind of a map of that. We can experience relationship with God in or through emptying or suffering. And the word kenosis to describe that comes right out of that Philippians text. We can experience relationship with God in and through creation, in our communities or in nature, God with us, or enosis. Or we can experience God in and through kind of a divine transformative union with God, or theosis, which increasingly enables us to grow and express Jesus in and through our own lives and being. The idea is that at any given time, we may experience God in any of these three ways or in combinations of these ways, but nothing falls outside of our transformative relationship with God.
That's great.
And the book, it kind of explores this Christ pattern, of course, in Jesus, but also how it's expressed in Paul's life and in the lives of other disciples, such as Francis of Assisi and Mother Teresa.
Yeah, great. And so, as you point out in the book, I think this is a point that's very important. It's not as though we pass through these stages once and then we're done, right? They kind of, they recursive relationship here. That you know, you pass through them, you know, this emptying relationship, and then some kind of transformative, sort of new way of existing in the world. But then, you know, we're right back in the middle of things again, and suddenly we need sort of new process of emptying again and building the relationship again with God. So it's an ongoing kind of a recursive process. But there is this pattern that does adhere, you know, across different stages of life.
That's right, Matt. So there's an overall kind of general progression in our lives. Sometimes I call that the master pattern through these three ways of kenosis, enosis, and theosis. But it's most helpful to think of them in terms of a helix model of spiritual experience, or imagined as kind of walking up a spiral staircase of spiritual experience with God as a strong central axis, or kind of our central relationship. We're moving in and out of these three ways of spiritual experience and blends of them throughout our lives, but we're always kind of moving upward, kind of progressing in the spiritual life. And yes, you know, what you said is so true, that you can have an experience of divine union, and it may well involve kenosis or enosis, and then we're on to the next thing. The three really intertwine and inform each other, and you know, bring us to the next place. As a really kind of simple, quick example of how they can kind of intertwine, something small but with a big impact. So you know, just the idea that we can have this every day in our lives. In the book, I give an example of Francis of Assisi describing one particular moment of embracing a leper, which was a pivotal moment in his spiritual life. It really drew him very deeply into a new place of his vocation. He said he had an intense aversion to lepers. So we can see in an embrace the kenosis of the self-emptying and personal risk. We can see the enosis, right, of embracing this person and love of this person who needs connection, who needs love, and it's his community. So we see that enosis, but we can also see the theosis, right? We can see the union with Jesus, in the sense that Francis was kind of standing in the place of Jesus with the leper, re-expressing the care of Jesus there.
Yeah, I like that. I really like that example of Francis in your book. And as you put it here, Laura, I think it's very good. You write in the book something you wrote that really I really stood out to me when I was reading it. Is this from about the middle of the book, maybe the latter two-thirds of it. You write that one cannot be touched by God and remain unchanged. In fact, the mystics suggest that the purpose of these touches is to change us and draw us closer to God. Yet the transformation instigated by revelation encountered is not simply for the sake of transformation alone. Okay, this idea that one cannot be touched by God and remain unchanged, it raises for me the question, since you're writing about Christian experience and not just Paul's experience, how do you find yourself touched by the divine? Are these encounters always dramatic, or do they occur in really subtle ways?
Oh, I think God touches us in any number of ways. And it seems to even kind of vary by individual, don't you think, Matt? But we each kind of have kind of our own musical score or our own watercolor palette. We each have our own relationship story with God that unfolds. I find that God touches and speaks to me in those three ways we talked about, kenosis, enosis, and theosis, which can occur in events, relationships, encounters with the natural world, scripture, prayer, especially prayer, a simple movement of the heart, and on and on. Encounters with God, I would say, are not always dramatic, though they can be. In my own spiritual life, sometimes they are clear and defined, sometimes subtle. Sometimes I just delight in discovering all the kind of gentle ways he speaks to me, perhaps in the garden, perhaps through a friend, perhaps in complete silence. But the thing I found that's the most important is prioritizing the relationship with God, and then whatever the encounters are, they just follow from there. But what about you, Matt? Do you experience encounters with God as dramatic or subtle?
Yeah, good. Okay, you turned my question back on me. This is a hard question. Actually, I really like how you said it, Laura. I do. It turns out I've actually written a book. It's on spiritual experience. It's coming out in a couple of months. And it kind of weaves by way of literature and also personal experience. And I find I try to explain instances there for me of how spiritual experience occurs in ways that have been in my life very dramatic, but also often very subtle. And what I find is that there's always an element to the experience, which is kind of the hallmark, the watermark of God's imprint. But that can occur, you know, in ways that are really big and dramatically life-changing, or in ways that are small and that just remind me that God's there. There's a great diversity, I find, of spiritual experience. And the key for me is learning how to discern an authentic one from one that is born from just my own desire for something to happen. And that discernment is key. That's what the discipline, I think, of the Christian disciple really has a lot to do with learning to discern the place of God in one's life.
Oh, I think that is wonderful. What you just said, Matt, and I couldn't agree more. That watermark that you mentioned, that discernment really is the key. And learning how in your relationship with God to figure out what that watermark is. I mean, maybe it involves peace, for example. How, you know, there's always something there that's going to let you know, what's speaking into your spirit is of God.
Absolutely. That's my experience. And you expressed that so well in your book. It's kind of a transitional question, I guess, toward your poetry. One of the examples of a transformed person in your book is Thérèse of Lisieux, a 19th century Carmelite mystic. And you tell of how she imagined herself, I'm quoting you here, a little bird, both small and flightless. She longed to be a powerful eagle that could fly to the heavens like the great saints and the angels, to be a mighty instrument of God. Now, she wasn't one of the great ones, she concluded, but she believed that God would not give her a desire he could not meet. And in commenting on this story, you write, quoting you again here, "Not only can the smallest birds gaze, they can perceive and communicate what they perceive to others. That is mystic vision. Ordinary events, ordinary interactions with people, ordinary prayer experiences contain powerful connections with the divine. If we are able to perceive the presence of the divine." It's beautiful, Laura. Was that Thérèse, you know, as bird, is that one of the things that made this title of your poetry, Litany of Flights, the title?
Oh, I love Thérèse's little bird. I mean, I'm sure you noticed that in I Live No Longer. I identify strongly with her little bird. And I think Thérèse is such a wonderful example of how we can all have that mystic vision or ability to perceive God at work in the world. Regarding my title, I would say yes, from the perspective of my identification with Thérèse's little bird, I'm definitely alluding to her and to my own litany of spiritual experience, if you will, in the title.
Okay. You know, I am a literature professor, and I love good poetry. And this book of poems, won the Paraclete Prize poetry, the Paraclete Press Poetry Prize competition. And when I read it, I thought, this is just beautiful. And my question really is you mentioned earlier you were journaling, but you'd written poetry when you were young. Have you written poetry all through your life, or did you write it when you were young, put it away, and then come back to these poems as a mature adult?
I have written poetry off and on my entire life, but I would say that I came into a different kind of poetry, kind of born out of my inner life. And that, you know, was cultivated, I think, more and more seriously through a writing practice, through workshops, conferences, mentors and things like that. So, you know, it's evolved into the kind of poetry it is today, with the writing combined in very equal part with a contemplative listening, a leaving room for what is asking to be written.
Yeah, okay, that contemplative part is really significant, really important in these poems. You know, it's these are devotional poems, and they're beautifully structured, they're elegantly articulated. My favorite thing about them, though, is the way they capture the effect of spiritual impressions. The kind of, that's the hallmark in a lot of ways of good contemplative writing and thinking. And there's often a surprising turn in the poems. There's often sort of depth of theological reflection in them. So, for example, this opening poem, Litany of Flights, the way it begins, just talking about different birds or different aspects of birds, you know, I'm just a couple lines here. First, the winged movement, steady, forward, scrub jays in flitting progress, hawks in predator glide, a ringing up, a knife sharp slope down. Second, and on it goes. We get through these several birds, and then it ends this way with the twelfth in a moment, caught up high by the beloved, the one making all things work together, wings, body, arch, air, caught up like the Shulamite bride to regions beyond aeronautical wisdom, transported in joy. And then this line, which you conclude, I love this line. See, he says, the painful paring of your hollow bones has made you light. What I love about that is it suggests that flight, which we associate with freedom and speed, you know, and becoming at some level, you know, the ability to take flight and to move, is here. It comes from a hollow paring of the bones, a hollowing out that is associated with suffering, pain, growth. I thought that was just so beautiful, Laura. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you, Matt, so much. Thank you so much for all these words about my poetry. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
How conscious were you in writing these poems that you were doing theology, right? Was that part of the creative process for you? Mm-hmm. Or did you have to block out the fact that there's theology here and simply let the poems reveal themselves to you on their own terms?
I would say that most of the time when I'm writing, I don't set out necessarily to write a poem which does theology, so to speak. Rather, I write out of my life, and my spirituality is so essential to my life that that has a way of kind of manifesting in the essence of the poems, even when the poem is not expressly concerned with a spiritual topic. But that being said, the poems in Litany of Flights came to me in all kinds of ways. Sometimes I would begin a poem with an image or an idea, and the theology would just kind of emerge simply because of who I am and the way I think about and experience things. I think the color ultramarine is a good example of that in the book. But a few of the poems did start off with a spark of recognition of a theological truth in an image or experience. Via Negativa Mourning Dove is a great example of that kind of poem. I had a mourning dove nesting near my front door, and it just became for me such an example of the Via Negativa, or the way of unknowing. So that's how that poem happened. But I would say that most of the time, poetry and theology integrate into one experience of writing for me.
Okay, yeah. If we had time, there are so many poems here. I'd be so happy just to read or have you read, because they're just so beautiful. Let me ask you about one of these here. The second poem in the volume, called On the Efficacy of a Prophet. I find this really provocative. You know, in it, you call the moon a sibyl, right? Whispering, the moon is a sibyl, whispers what she does not fathom, you write. And yet the poem concludes on such a profound note. And here's the last stanza. What I hear in the deep, she is a royal messenger, gentle ray, and what she speaks bends the burn. What she beams flickers plunder, the little words of the sun I can bear. Okay, that image of the moon reflecting or plundering the sun's light, as much light as the poet can bear, it's lovely. And it's so illustrative of the nature of spiritual experience, right? We take the small little bits we're able to withstand. Mm-hmm. Do you consider your poems lunar bodies to the solar energy of the theology or the God they reflect? Or might you say instead that the theology you write is the reflection or the plundering of the powerful spiritual experience the poems convey?
Oh, I love that question. I would say that you are right as to both. That the theology and the poetry each supply necessary light to each other. And yet, I also really view the divine as the sun, bright beyond our seeing, and that we humans look to the moons of theology and poetry to contemplate what they plunder from the sun. Two very different languages trying to express the same brightness.
Okay. I mean, it's they really work so beautifully and harmoniously, the theological and kind of surprising kind of literary qualities of the poems. It just they're gorgeously rendered that way. I wonder, your poem, another poem in here, Evidence of a Burning Bush, I think is really provocative in this regard. It very movingly compares the famed bush in Exodus, right? Burning but unconsumed, right? Through which God calls out mm-hmm. to Moses, is Exodus 3. And you compare that bush with a blackened sugar bush burned in a fire, right? You must be from California, Laura, thinking about forest fire.
I am.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I am too, by the way, originally from California. So is my wife. Anyway, the poem's ending here is so thought-provoking. I'll just read a few lines of it here. You write, "Which, I wonder, is the stronger, weaker case for the groping heart in anguished hope? The bush which burns bright without hurt, searing evermore, or the sugar bush that knows unknown agony of inferno, brokenness, a death, a life unsuspected and divine rejoinder, fire death birthing fire life, ashes for seed burst into being." Such a provocative question. Which is the stronger, the bush that burns forever and is not consumed, or the bush that knows death, right? But then ashes for seed mm-hmm. burst into being. How would you answer the really provocative question that poem poses?
I think it is one thing to see God's action in scripture, in the burning bush. It is another to perceive God's effectiveness underlying everyday events which involve suffering and even destruction. In both cases, God's action is paradoxical. The bush in Exodus burns, but is unconsumed. That's a paradox. In the case of the very real sugar bush in California, which burns to the ground in a wildfire, the bush burns, and yet from its ashes comes new life. Also paradoxical, though harder to see. This poem is kind of asking if we can see the paradox of the cross in our everyday lived experience, if we can see even in dark and destructive things, that there could be those two simultaneous and competing realities of loss and gain. And I think if we can perceive that in our daily lives, it makes a powerful case to choose to live out of the fire life.
Yeah, it's beautifully said, and it's a profound principle. I know the people I really know and really revere as spiritually evolved beings in my own circle of acquaintance, so many of them have known profound loss, and they are like that sugar bush you're describing, you know, where they've not been mm-hmm. preserved from suffering, but they reflect something mm-hmm. really divine mm-hmm. through it. And I think it's a profound principle, and I love the way you give expression to the paradox there, that the more afflicted, also the more sanctified. It's mm-hmm. beautiful, Laura, mm-hmm. thank you. I wonder if we could talk about one of my favorite poems in the collection, The Filling Tree. Mm-hmm. I thought this was such an elegant poem. Would you, just to give the poet's voice to this, would you read this poem for our listeners?
Of course, I'd love to, thank you. The Filling Tree. corner gas station, snaked with dusty cars, slaking thirst, owners just as parched. It's Sunday, but everyone is looking down, away, distant from the low-slung concrete walls, the wafting petroleum fumes, the rumbling throaty trucks, and VW bugs with curled lashes. Next door, if you look over, sits a drab house with antenna, perched tight as an insect. On its desiccated patch of yard, bang against the peeling concrete wall, rises an astonishing coral tree. If you're looking, you blink twice. Check to see if you are wearing your rose-tinted sunglasses, but no, you left them in the driver's seat. You marvel at the red. It's not fire engine, nor some lurid logo designed to subconsciously prompt shopping for laundry detergent. No, it is fire, and even flares of bloom over dark boughs, and probably reaching over the air and water station, confident in its living florets of blood spilled extravagantly for all. If you're looking, you sense serene roots held in being, lit by being. You catch the silent, steady burn of the blossoms, the outpouring of exuberant mercy. You want to remember this always, this red apparition, not for its existence, nor its flaming flowers, but because it chooses as its companions the empty tanks, the changed oil lights, the flat tires, the ones who notice and the ones who do not.
Bravo. You know, I'm in the room here with Abby Thatcher, who's the podcast producer, and we were both trying hard not to laugh out loud at some of the early lines, which so brilliantly capture kind of postmodern dereliction, right? Gas station fumes, VW bugs with curled lashes. I mean, it's brilliant. But then right out of all this, you know, sort of postmodern absurdity, something really sublime emerges. It's so gorgeous, this gorgeous tree with all of these colors. And yet it's not the colors, finally, on which the poem focuses. It's not the color alone or the contrast between the beauty of the tree and kind of the drab concrete, you know, sort of burned out nature of its surrounding, but rather a thought, right? A theological principle. It chooses as its companions the empty tanks, the change oil lights, the flat tires, the ones who notice and the ones who do not. It is a beautiful Christian vision. And you think about Christ, including those who reject or ignore him, right? What I love about this image in the poem is that it's a non-exclusionary vision of the gospel message, right? The tree is there for those who notice it and for those who don't notice it. Christ is there for those who notice and those who don't. And it suggests that if there is exclusion, it's we who exclude ourselves, not God who excludes us.
Thank you so much, Matt. I love the image also for that very reason. It's a gorgeous beauty, a love poured out in the middle of the completely ordinary and mundane for all. And it's up to us to notice, to look, and to see.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And really moving to me. I'm teaching a class this semester, and we're going to read this poem, a few poems out of your book. We're going to assign some poems and talk about them.
We've
been reading things like by Gerard Manley Hopkins and Denise Levertov and R.S. Thomas. We're going to include here Laura Rees Hogan. And so, looking forward to that.
What an honor. Thank you.
You know, Laura, let me close with this question right here. You articulate a beautiful Christian vision, really a beautiful spiritual vision, amid the rigors and the turbulence and the traumas, really, of everyday life. Do you ever lose sight of this vision that both your books, your theology, and your poetry convey? If you do lose sight of it, what do you do to regain it?
Oh, yes, I would say the turbulence, great word, of everyday life can be a challenge for, I think, everyone. And in my case, I think I have my Carmelite spirituality to thank for giving me ways to regain it, hopefully fairly quickly. Those ways involve a daily prayer practice, whether the prayer is dry or not, and a well of spiritual wisdom to draw on, even in times of great turbulence or divine absence, which is a real challenge. And I think spiritual community is so important. And I find that in my lay Carmelite community and also in individual spiritual friendships. And that's so nourishing for me. So all of these things together help me to come back to that place of connection and peace.
Fantastic. Yeah, I find myself that a community, a religious community, and spiritual practices, both those things combined, do get us through those times of turbulence and difficulty. They do me, and they clearly they do you. And thank you so much for the beautiful work that you do, Laura, and for taking time to talk with me today. It's been a joy. I appreciate this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Matt. It's been a pleasure, a joy to be with you too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.